Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
My name is Carl. I'm a librarian in the History Department and our Reference Department upstairs here at the library. And we're happy to host this author reading with our community partners at Elliott Bay Books. Tonight we have, do you want to be Bill or William?
Bill is fine. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We're going to be informal. Tonight we have Bill Wyckoff, Professor of Geography in the Department of Earth Sciences at Montana State University, to talk about his new book, How to Read the American West, A Field Guide. Bill's a native of Southern California. He now makes his home in Bozeman. Other book projects that he's focused on have to do with the Western landscape, and they include a re-photographic survey of Montana called On the Road Again, Montana's Changing Landscape, a historical geography of Colorado titled Creating Colorado, The Making of a Western Landscape, 1860 to 1940. He's also the co-author of a college textbook in world regional geography by the title of Diversity Amid Globalization, World Regions, Environment, and Development. That title sounds like a committee wrote it, Bill. Is that right?
It's one of those textbook four-author kind of things, yes.
Yeah, yep.
But fun project.
So in format today, we're going to do what we typically do, which is to have Bill do his presentation for about half an hour, and then we're going to be open to questions. I think we're all set, so here's
okay.
Bill. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much. Thank you. Well, thanks very much for coming out this evening in a very beautiful summer week in Seattle. I've been here a couple of days, and I hear this weather is a little bit unusual, but it's nice to have it 85 and up in terms of temperature. What I'd like to do this evening is just quickly share with you some of the background for how my new book came together, and also talk a little bit about some of the examples that I use in the book. And if you were able to pick up a little green sheet, you can see on the back some of the 100 features that I write about in the book. And then thirdly, a little bit about what I learned overall in terms of putting together a book on the West as a historical cultural geographer, which is what I teach at Montana State University. So we can get started. I do want to thank my friends at the University of Washington Press who published the book right here in good old Seattle, and also because the book came out in a series that is subsidized and helped out by the Weyerhaeuser Foundation. I want to thank them, and then thank my colleagues at Montana State University. I did a good deal of writing on the book in 2012 during a sabbatical leave. The idea of a field guide for this particular project really got me thinking about doing something a little bit different than the standard field guide, which might be a field guide to geology or a field guide to birds or that sort of thing. And what I wanted to do is look at everyday Western landscapes, not just physical landscapes, and that's in the Madison Valley in Montana, not too far from where I live, actually, on the left there, but also cultural landscapes. The fact that the IHOP in Santa Fe, New Mexico, looks different than the one down on Madison. And to talk about how that aspect of culture in the everyday landscape makes the West a special kind of place. So in my book, I do want to talk about everyday landscapes like agricultural fields, like these strawberry fields in Salinas, California, or everyday places like commercial strips. This is good old Colfax Avenue in Denver, if you've been through Denver. It goes on for miles and miles, and every city, of course, has strips, right, where you have a lot of different commercial activities. All in one place there, you can get a payday loan, a tattoo, and a piercing, right, on East Colfax. So why write a guidebook like this, right? It might sound like kind of an interesting, fun project, but why did I do it? Well, I came up, I guess, with three reasons, really. This shot right here is in Mormon country in Mount Pleasant, Utah. One is that as a cultural historical geographer, I would argue that Western landscapes tell us a lot about ourselves, about our history, about our setting, about that relationship between people and environment. We use the landscape as an indicator about a place and how a place got to be that way. One cultural geographer once said, the landscape is our unwitting autobiography, right? It's how we interpret where we've come from. That's the Bitterroot Valley, by the way, south of Missoula, if you're familiar with that area. It's gotten a lot of sort of second home settlement along the foothills there, and a lot of also people that are working in Missoula and live down here in this very nice setting. Some of the landscapes that I talk about in the book are quite formal places, like Denver's Civic Center area, kind of a function of the City Beautiful movement and laid out in the early 20th century. And then some are quite informal, like our front yards. I like this one. This is in Lakewood, California. The guy couldn't decide whether he liked cactus or grass, right? So went with a sort of a split deal. But the argument being that our front yards and our city centers tell us something about ourselves and our values and what we think is important and so on. Secondly, the book gave me, as a geographer, an opportunity to paint a new regional portrait of the West. And in doing that, this is in Central California near Salinas, by the way, in doing that, I surely wanted to appreciate history, like mining history. This is near my home area at Butte, Montana. Also Native American history, certainly. This is in on the road up to the Flathead Valley in western Montana. But also to look at a newer West, places like Little India in Southern California, places that when I was a kid growing up in Los Angeles were not populated by many, many South Asian Americans. And those places have been transformed since the 1970s. And thirdly, I guess the reason I wrote the book is because the West, like it is for a lot of you folks, is your home. It's my home. I care about it. And it is a period of time in which the West is seeing a lot of change. Some of it is inevitable and no doubt good, but other parts of it make me wonder. This is a landscape just west of where I live in Bozeman, Montana. The foreground is the new West there, right, with these lots subdivided for rural non-farmers. And then the background is the more traditional sort of, cropping and ranching West. But the West is changing a lot. So are we making sustainable choices when we build the Arizona waterfront here in Scottsdale, right? Are we making sustainable choices in fragile places like this? This is just east of Las Cruces, New Mexico, in a new housing development going in. You can see it kind of from start to finish there, if you will, right? And those different layers of construction. Are we building communities that are destined for permanence? This one doesn't look too permanent, does it? It's Wham Sutter, Wyoming. It's in the energy patch. And energy is transforming a lot of areas of Montana, of Wyoming, of New Mexico, Utah, Colorado as well. So how do you tell the story about the Western landscape? I wanted to do a field guide format. One option would be road logs, but there are so damn many highways in the West, right? That would get, the book would be 1,000 pages at least. I could have gone state by state, but I ended up going with sort of a broad topical approach that you folks see if you look at those 100 features. I came up with those 100 features. There's nothing sacred about that list, but I thought it would be a manageable number that wouldn't make a 900-page book to go with a round number. And, you know, there's obviously lots of different kinds of additions you could make to it. In fact, we can talk about some of your ideas after my presentation. What I tried to do was provide a nice varied sampling, including things like grain elevators is one of my choices here. So for each feature, I tried to define and describe the feature, tried to tell a little bit something about its history, its habitat, in other words, where you find the feature, something about regional variations. That's a shot of Bannock, Montana, a ghost town, one of my features, one of the coolest ghost towns in the West, I think. It's a state park in southwestern Montana. And just provide some tips for looking at that feature in the field, right? How to interpret it, how to understand it and enjoy it. That is, I'm just going to go through the chapter titles really quickly with you. This is part of the early part of the book in which I talk about the natural fundament, sagebrush, cloudscapes. This is central Wyoming. Then I have a chapter entitled Farms and Ranches. That looks at things like irrigation systems, right, and orchards and cattle ranching, features like that. Then I have a chapter on extractive landscapes, mining, logging, coal, energy, all those sorts of things. There's our shot from Butte. Then I have a chapter, for lack of a better title, I labeled Places of Special Cultural Identity. This is a village in southern Colorado, San Luis. It's a good example of a Hispano Plaza town, which are quite thick in northern New Mexico and southern Colorado. But also in this section, I've got some treatment of things like Japanese internment camps and African-American communities in the West and Mormon country in the West, places that have special cultural identity. Then I have a chapter just called Connections, you know, and talk about Western trails, railroads, things like the open road, you know, and that's a very Western-looking scene, isn't it? It's one of my favorite pictures in the book, actually. It's taken in central Nevada. Maybe you've heard of US 50 as the loneliest highway in America, right? Well, this is the old US 50. This is bypassed US 50, right? This used to be the Lincoln Highway back in the 20s, and it's still a paved road, and it's still maintained, but you probably won't see much traffic on it. It's southwest of Austin, and it veers off the current US 50. So I have a chapter on connections. Then I have a chapter on federal largesse in the West. That was pretty obvious to me. I needed to talk about that. National forests, national parks, Bureau of Land Management lands, military lands like these in southern New Mexico. Then a chapter on cities and suburbs, because after all, most of us in the West live in cities and suburbs, right? The West isn't all cowboys and Indians and range wars and so forth. So this is down at the LA Music Center in where I was born and raised. In fact, I remember as a little kid when they opened that up. And again, it's a reminder about all the new kinds of reimaginings of our central city landscapes. We've got plenty of examples of that here in Seattle as well. But I also talk about suburban life and suburban California bungalows and ranch houses and those kinds of topics. And then lastly, I had to have a chapter on playgrounds, you know, ski resorts, rodeos, you know, those kinds of things, dude ranches. Golf courses. This is in central Colorado at Copper Mountain. Doing the field work took me a few years between March of 2008 and August 2013. I did visit and revisit all 11 western states, that is from New Mexico up to Montana and then out to the coast. I did visit all the major metropolitan areas of the West in doing this project. And as one of those weird things that geographers do, I made sure I visited all 414 western counties. Just to say I could get there and kind of knew what it looked like, you know. If I was going to write a field guide to the West, I figured I'd better at least look at. I'm not saying I know everything about all those counties. Believe me, I don't. But I did visit them all. There's about 420 images in the book, including this one taken at Manzanar, one of those Japanese internment camps in the Owens Valley. If you've been there, you surely know the setting. It's very moving. It's just east of the Sierra Nevada. Along with the press, we produced 30 new maps and diagrams for the book, too. I wanted to share briefly one of the 100 features with you, just in terms of how to look at these places. And the one I chose was the urban wildland interface. These are places in the West, they're pretty common, where you have urban and suburban land come right up next to national forests, Bureau of Land Management land, wide open land, basically, right? And I guess my point in the book is, this is west of Denver, by the way, a good example of that, is that there are several different ways you can look at these settings. One is to look at them as ecological mixing zones. And what I meant by that was that these are fascinating places where you have all the things that we bring into these neighborhoods, right, mixing with what is off there to the right. This is on the east edge of Albuquerque, New Mexico, on the foothills of the Sandia Mountains here. And so these are places where house pets and mountain lions mingle, not always peacefully, right? And they're also places of a lot of environmental fragility. And so when people start building lots of houses in these settings, they find themselves facing floods, they find themselves facing wildfire hazards and so forth, because these are oftentimes very, very transitional, delicate kinds of environments. So there we have our scene in Albuquerque, right on the east edge of suburban settlement there. A second way to look at these places is as contested political turf. And what I mean by that is that these are places that oftentimes have lots of different jurisdictions. Some of this land might be city land, some of it might be county, some of it might be National Forest, Bureau of Land Management. And so these are highly politicized spaces when it comes to issues like open space and water and land use. So when you go to a place like, this is on the east side of Tucson, right near Sabino Canyon. If you've ever hiked around Sabino Canyon, it's on the east side. Really nice place to hike. But it's just, this area has grown up a lot in the last 30 or 40 years, right below the Santa Catalina Mountains there, which are national forest. They're even a wilderness area right there. And then a third way to look at these settings is simply as different kinds of settlement patterns. I'm a geographer, so I'm fascinated with patterns, visible and spatial patterns on the surface of the earth. That's what geographers do. So you can look at things like our Albuquerque example as simply where settlement comes right up to a border, a boundary, a barrier, and stops, the kind of abrupt edge, urban wildland meeting place, if you will. In other cases, you might have something we might call interdigitation. Planned in this case, this is interdigitation in the East Bay, which is up above Concord, California, where you have a planned interweaving, right, of open space and houses. In some cases, you might have leapfrogging, where a whole new, often typically planned subdivision or retirement village or what have you is created and is completely surrounded by open land. That was the case with Fountain Hills, Arizona, back in the 70s and 80s when it was begun east of Phoenix. Or you might have the lone pioneer up there, right? The lone eagle building his castle, if you will, and maybe to be filled in later, maybe not. But this is one example of that in the Santa Catalina Mountains above Tucson. So what did I learn from the Western landscape after, you know, going out there for several years, really, and doing some of these other earlier books on the West as well? What did I learn? I want to just try to synthesize some things I learned in the next 15 minutes here that aren't, you know, I've repackaged them and can zero in a little bit with you folks with them tonight. This, by the way, is one of the most interesting things about the Coalinga, California landscape. If you've been to Coalinga, it's energy rich, but sort of scenery poor. It's in a hot, dry part of the San Joaquin Valley. It would be northwest of Bakersfield, California. And a very creative artist back in the 70s decorated a lot of the pump rigs around. So you have all these fanciful dinosaurs and reptiles and zebras and so forth that have ornamented the pump landscape here. So what did I learn? Well, I guess one thing I learned is that the scale of capital investment in the West and the scale of the economies of scale in the West have sort of encouraged a bigness in the Western landscape. And what I mean by that is that when you go to visit a paying gold mine now, this is the Carlin Gold Mine in northern Nevada, the mine holes are huge, right? The scale of mining is big. The trucks are huge. The people are very small. But you find that as a kind of repeating theme, that theme of bigness in the West. So when it comes to orange groves, they're industrial scale orange groves like these in the eastern part of the San Joaquin Valley. Or when you're looking at sunflower farming in eastern Colorado near the Kansas border, this is not the high country of Colorado, right? It's the other Colorado. The fields seem like they go on forever. We all know there are larger but fewer farms today for those economic reasons in the United States generally. Or when it comes to old-fashioned wind turbines, to the upper left there, right, and the new-fashioned wind turbine, lower right. The one in the upper left is northern New Mexico on a ranch. The one on the lower right is in the Tehachapi Pass area. Wind energy, which is terrific in many settings, but the scale of making that affordable and making it economic means you scale it up on the landscape, right? Or our example of the huge housing development on the east side of Las Cruces. Big, big, capital-rich kinds of investments. Or the same in ski areas. When I first went to Breckenridge as a kid, it was a little dying mining town. And now it's one of the West's largest ski areas, as many of you know if you're a skier. The second thing I learned is in terms of what the landscape was telling me, and it's nothing that people haven't written about, but it's that between 2015 and 2050, it looks very, very plain to me where a lot of the population growth is going to continue to occur. One of those kinds of settings are on the edges of metropolitan areas. This is literally the edge of Fort Collins, Colorado, all right? And that's mandated open space to the right, on the right-hand side of the image. All those houses are facing, you can just imagine if you would out there somewhere outside of the screen, the front range of the Rockies. Great views, right? But the edge of our big cities, the edges of our big cities are going to continue to grow. Also, our smaller micropolitan centers, places like St. George, Utah, which saw substantial growth in the 1990s and then tailed off a little bit, certainly in the last 5 or 10 years, I think are already beginning to reaccelerate again. People come here to retire. They come here to build a second home. They come here because they can work from anywhere, and they like the color country of southern Utah. In fact, this was the last picture that I took for the book. This was less than a year ago that I took this picture. I think it was about 108 degrees that day. Believe me, it was last summer in St. George, Utah, if you know that area. But those places, or places like my hometown of Bozeman, Montana, would be another good example of something like that. Then a third type of setting are areas completely outside of what we might call urban or town development, and that is simply rural amenity living, like this example in central Colorado near Dillon, Colorado, or much of the greater Yellowstone area where I live, where people are just building, often for seasonal occupants only, those kinds of houses for view shed and access to winter and summer sports, those kinds of settings. And then our scene from Wamsutter, Wyoming, a reminder that the energy patch is selectively going to continue to drive a lot of growth. Go to northeastern Montana today. Go to Williston, North Dakota, or go to Farmington, New Mexico, or Wamsutter, Wyoming, and you do see the impact of the energy boom. Booms come and go. That's why we call them booms. You know, they don't last forever, but there are certainly going to be several, I think, cycles of this one that we're currently in, certainly. The third thing I learned was really more of a cultural thing, and again, it's something that folks in Seattle know very well, and I was born and raised in Los Angeles, but it's that especially since 1970, there's been so much more cultural transformation in the West. I mean, the West has a rich cultural heritage, right, with Native Americans and a variety of folks from Asia and from Latin America and so on, but we've had a lot of recent post-World War II changes, really, and post-1970 changes. This is a great mural in Albuquerque, New Mexico, celebrating some of the long Hispano heritage of that state. But what I'm talking about, too, is much more recent. In the case of Latinization of the West, if you look at the 2010 census, 29% of the West population is Latino. L.A. County's Latino population now exceeds that of the entire country of Costa Rica. So that's part of what I'm talking about, and it's very much a part of the landscape in many, many interesting ways. This is a once Anglo farm town, Orange Cove, California, in the San Joaquin Valley that's become Latinized since 1980, and today over 70%, 80% of its population is Latino. And so you have all the old storefronts that have been repurposed to many of the new families that are there, many of them working in the agricultural sector. Another kind of neat example, this is a subdivision that was built in the late 1940s by Del Webb, the big resort and subdivision developer across the West. He built something called Pueblo Gardens on the south side of Tucson. And in fact, it made the cover of Life magazine in the late 1940s. And it was for many, many years a kind of Anglo, you know, go to the Southwest and retreat in the Southwest. And now it's a Latino barrio on the south side of Tucson. And so it's gone through that cycle, and it's got a different cultural fabric now than it did when Del Webb first built them in the 1940s. And you have interesting hybridities, interesting mixes, like Mi Favorita Market. This is in Toppenish, Washington, on the other side of the hills from us here, where you have had again, since the 1940s, a major Latino influence in that community. Or one of my favorites, La Palma Mexicatessen. This is in the Mission District of San Francisco. And again, a fascinating area of cultural mixing and so on. There's also been a diverse Asian American transformation. This is just down the road here in the International District of Seattle. But just a reminder that especially in Washington, in Oregon and California, and now increasingly in cities like Phoenix and Las Vegas and many others in the American West, you're seeing really this newer wave of Asian American influence. Very, very diverse. Mostly urban, but not always. And if you look at the census of 2010, actually, the Asian immigrants were outpacing the Latino immigrants. Now, I don't know how that's going to play out this year with all the headlines we're seeing and so on, but it's just showing you the diversity. And it's really creating some, again, some great landscape mixing. This is in Monterey Park in California, in Los Angeles, a large Chinese settlement there, Chinese-American suburb there. And what you have here is an old 70s-style apartment house that now has been sort of repurposed and is now lived in by Chinese-Americans. And again, they've changed in subtle ways the look of the place in terms of some of the ornamentation, some of the design aspects of if you will, their front yard, right? This is less subtle, but this is a huge shopping mall in Little Saigon in Southern California, and basically a part of that very, very dynamic Southeast Asian community in that part of Southern California. Mini mall signs are great ways to take the pulse of some of that cultural change. This is a mini mall sign. I know if you're in the back, you can't read all those different businesses, but they include places like Mai Lin Books and Gifts, Denise's Donuts, and El Pollo Rico restaurant. And so it's just a reminder, this is near San Jose, California, right, of that kind of cultural diversity. The fourth thing I learned was that regional landscapes remain richly symbolic. This is actually a sculpture, okay? And so I thought I was seeing a mirage when I first saw it in southeastern New Mexico. It's south of Hobbs, by the way. It's basically West Texas. It's a great sculpture. It was just put up a few years ago. And again, it's obviously celebrating the range cattle heritage and the cowboy heritage of that part of the West. Well, I guess my point is that we have a lot of symbolically rich landscapes out there. Some of them, you know, are traced right back to things like physical landscape features, like wild animals and wild lands, open spaces. And some of them basically are resonating, I think, with cultural features like cowboy culture and exoticized visions of native peoples or simply maybe the open road, that sort of thing. So when it comes to, I'll just go through these quickly, but when it goes to getting a room for the night, you can, in the old, you know, a stereotype, you can sleep in a teepee, right, in Holbrook, Arizona. Or if you want to gamble in New Mexico, south of Albuquerque, you can go to a casino, an Indian casino, that looks like that, right, done in Pueblo styling. Or if you want to buy real estate in Kellogg, Idaho, which is a silver mining area, you would, of course, go to the Miner's Hat Realty, right, which celebrates the silver legacy, the mining legacy there. Or if you want to go sip a cocktail in Breckenridge, Colorado, you would go to the Dredge Restaurant, perhaps, which is really reconnoitering back to the mining history and the dredge boats that worked the old mine tailings and so forth. So that symbolic landscape is fun and an interesting part of what we are in the West. Art towns are great destinations for exploring these things, places like Santa Fe, New Mexico. Here's Tubac, Arizona, which is a great little art town. In fact, yesterday I was up at La Conner in Washington near here, which is a nice example of looking at how, you know, creative local people are interpreting landscape in sculptures and paintings and so forth. Also, public art is a great place to look at these kinds of signatures. The one on the left there is simply in the Mission District of San Francisco on the side of a building. And the one on the right is down an alley in Superior, Arizona, old mining town, and also one with a lot of old Hispano-Latino connections. The fifth thing I learned is that landscapes are a great window into the past. And, of course, we're used to seeing that in a geological sense in terms of looking at a place like Monument Valley, right, and thinking about those layers of time, or more intimately along the Watchman Trail in Zion Park of looking at those layers of rock along the trail, right? But I also would call your attention to looking at this in a cultural kind of way, looking at a building, for example, as a kind of layering of time. So this is, in fact, this is the first illustration of the book. And it's an old bank building in Magdalena, New Mexico, that was built around the turn of the century, went belly up in the Depression, and then was reinvented as a little cafe and fountain, and went through several owners, and that went belly up. And then finally, more recently, the Village Press there, it's sort of an art press studio, has reoccupied the building. So you learn how to read buildings a little bit and read how they're layers of time that are accumulated in the buildings in one fashion or another. Farmsteads are another way to deal with that. You can read a lot of things through time on farmsteads. So this is in eastern Colorado, and there's the, it may not be the original farmstead, but it's certainly the main home now. And then right in here, you can kind of look at some of the early, probably early vestiges of the folk landscape, maybe that came with the first homesteaders. This is sort of the mother-in-law solution here, right? The double wide out back. And then you've got some other, you know, accumulations of different technologies and different times that are part of that farmstead landscape, right? So that's what I mean about reading time into the landscape. You can also do it in terms of abandonment. This used to be, for example, a narrow gauge railroad line. Now it is a running path and a biking path in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Got a lot of these around the West, right? Or the abandoned roadscapes that we can tease out of the landscape quite easily. Sometimes they're even in fun places like off the 405 freeway in Irvine, California. And this is an abandoned off-ramp now being reclaimed by Ice Plant here as they've redesigned the freeway over the years. Or certainly an interesting example of a very optimistic city planner, and that is this is the city hall for Rio Rancho, New Mexico, right? And certainly thinking about, you know, what's going to come in tomorrow's landscape and how this is going to fill in. It's all planned to be filled in. And maybe it'll be fun to go in 20 years and take a picture of it from the exact same spot and look at how it has filled in, or maybe it hasn't. And then the last thing I learned was that a great, and I didn't know how timely this suggestion was going to be, right, in terms of Washington, I guess, this week. But a great way to learn about landscapes is to get high. The only thing I mean by that is that you benefit from looking at a landscape from different perspectives, you know, not just from one angle, but oftentimes getting above it and looking at different kinds of patterns at different kinds of scales. That's Lake Las Vegas, New Mexico, which became one of the biggest bankruptcy, you know, financial problems in the real estate bust of 2008 to 2010. Just a couple quick examples of this. Irrigation from the ground perspective, irrigation from the hill perspective, looking at center pivot irrigation. That's in south of Burns, Oregon, Steens Mountain in the background, great part of Oregon. Or the little chapel in Chimayo, New Mexico, great pilgrimage place. You're standing there, you have a feeling of the intimacy of the place. But if you climb up nearby Crucifix Hill and you can look out, you can get a better sense of the overall settlement pattern and its relation between the settlements and those nearby irrigated fields and so on. One last one here in San Francisco, you'll recognize it, I think. There's Coit Tower, right? And you can kind of see the blizzard of wires and the buildings and so forth. And that's what it looks like when you get up in Coit Tower and look out across San Francisco. And again, you see the irrationality of trying to put that rectangular city plan, right, across one of the most topographically varied settings in the West. You simply have a different sense of the landscape. We're running a little bit short on time. I'm going to show you the last 10 photos. I put together a top 10 list, okay, of images from the book, and then I'll open it up to questions. And I just put these in for various reasons. This is in eastern Washington, the Palouse country, beautiful wheat farming landscape, in many ways a sort of traditional scene. But I would just quickly point out that most of that wheat goes to East Asia. And we don't consume it locally, right? It's just a subtle reminder about globalization in the West, I guess. Number 9 on my list is from my state of Montana. It's just the country schoolhouse west of Havre. It's a reminder of how much rural depopulation is an issue around many Western settings. We don't think of it a lot here in Western Washington, but it's certainly the case in northern Montana. Here's a Washington one you may recognize. It's Ritzville. Again, it's a great old farming and agricultural town, but it's easy to get a parking place in Ritzville right now, unfortunately, right? I mean, there's not a lot going on downtown. I did like this creative mix. You can't see it that easily, but it's a single store here that's a quilt shop and a liquor store all in one. You know, kind of, there's some innovating going on there, right? But it is a reminder about our small towns that are under stress. Number 7 on my list was this just classic Utah sheep drive. And also a reminder, I just took that through the windshield. It's a reminder that sometimes the best photographs are the ones you don't plan on, you know, all, just the ones that happen. And this is in central Utah. Number 6 I put in here because of the suburban sprawl. I'm literally standing on the south side of the Denver metropolitan area here, looking, if you look carefully, there's downtown right there, about 40 miles away. Just a reminder about the extent of sprawl. Number 5 on my list was the Segerstrom Center for the Arts in Irvine, California, a reminder about the creative and new ways in which we're retooling and reimagining our central cities. Just a really fascinating, great landscape to photograph. Number 4 was in Los Angeles. I just like the juxtaposition of culture and language here in Koreatown with Casa Shoes, selling the shoes. And Los Angeles has to be, probably along with Seattle and San Francisco, some of the most culturally fascinating places of diversity in the West, certainly. Had to put Vegas in there, right? In fact, Vegas is number 100 on my overall list of features. And this was probably, I mean, I couldn't figure out any other way to categorize it, right? It's a fantasy landscape, obviously. I think this was my favorite shots that I took in Vegas, obviously of the Luxor Hotel. Number 2 was a picture I put in for several reasons. First of all, it's one of my favorite places. It's Glacier National Park in northern Montana. This is Two Medicine Lake on the east side of the park. It also is a reminder of how important open space, wilderness, public lands are in the West, and that is such a defining part of what the West is. And then the number 1 shot, you might say, oh, wow, what a bummer, you know. But it's a shot I took, and you might argue, well, it's the energy economy and it's an important shot and so forth. But that's not why I threw it on the top of my list. It made me, for a short time, an All Points Bulletin as a suspected industrial terrorist in the state of Wyoming because I took this shot. Now, I'm on a public road here, by the way, but I was seen as acting suspicious. And I was seen as having an out-of-state car from Montana, right? So I was reported to the sheriff. And the sheriff ends up calling my home in Montana, gets my son on the line, right, and says, what does your dad do for a living, the sheriff says. My son said, well, he's a cultural geographer. Well, the sheriff really probably got worried then. You know, what the heck's a cultural geographer? So make a long story short, about an hour later, the sheriff got my cell phone, and he called me. And we had an interesting conversation. I was about 100 miles east of here, and I thought, I'm getting a phone call from the sheriff. Maybe I ran a red light in Casper or something, you know? And I said, you know, after he explained the case, and I made my case, I'm writing this book and so forth, I said, isn't it a shame in the United States of America that an American citizen can't stand on public land anymore and take a picture? And he made a good counterargument and said, well, I'm responsible for, you know, making sure these things don't go up in flame and so forth. So we had a good accommodating conversation, and I got taken off the America's Most Wanted list, you know, in Wyoming at least. I think my son still wonders what I was doing, you know, in Wyoming, in terms of the sheriff calling him anyway. So just a last thought, and then I'll open it up to questions. What I found was not one West at all. There are a lot of Wests out there. I think we all know that, right? That's why there are at least 400 images in the book. And they certainly vary from the good life to the street life. This is a homeless part of Los Angeles, just within a stone's throw of downtown. And what I try to do in the book is try to include a little bit of all of those things just to give a sense of how to make people, hopefully yourselves, more curious about that everyday scene. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention and be happy to take any questions or comments. Sir, yeah. Yeah, it was a real challenge. He's asking about, you know, yeah, the division of space in the book, really, right? How much space devoted to different settings, different kinds of landscapes. And, you know, I know that a lot of the geology folks, for example, have put together a lot of good road guides, for example, right? And a lot of good state geological guides to reading physical landscapes. I didn't want to kind of redo their work. So what I try to do in the book is try to provide a broader sort of sampling of the ways we think about landscape. But I agree with you. And it's frustrating to me. You know, if I'd had my druthers, of course the press is here too, but I'd have 800 pictures. But you do have to work within the reality, right, of making it a manageable book. So, but I agree with you. I sympathize with your frustration as an author. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. That's a very good question. I mean, and I do address that in several places in the book, and I am a geographer, so I teach, you know, about global climate change, and which is going to have, I think, especially pronounced consequences for the southwestern part of the country, given a lot of the models. I don't know. Part of it will come from what the market demands in terms of price. In other words, people will pay more for it. But it's not going to come literally down the Colorado River necessarily, right? And so people will go to more and more diverse and disparate sites to tap into other drainages, to tap into aquifers. But aquifers go down, as we already know, and they're already going down. So I think that is a risk of a place like Las Vegas, for example, when you think about that setting, you know, and all the water that's consumed there. It's an excellent question to which no one has an answer. Certainly in many parts of the interior West, it's a huge question. And thanks for asking it, yeah. Yes? In the Boise area? I've been through Boise. I know what you mean. And, I remember going through Boise as a kid, and it was a relatively little, small Idaho town, right? And it has, because of a lot of the a kind of a high-tech component there, I think, they've become a little, certainly since the 90s, they've become a focus of relatively high-amenity industrial manufacturing. In other words, they can draw a good workforce there because they have the playground of Southern Idaho, right, in their backyard, at the same time, they're pretty well positioned with regard to shipping things out to different parts of the country, different parts of the world. I think Boise is going to continue along, by the way, with Twin Falls. If we want to talk Idaho, I would include Twin Falls and Idaho Falls to the east as secondary areas, because I drive through those areas pretty frequently. And those places are continuing to grow. And they're getting a little Boise spillover there, I think, you know. But lower cost land, good labor force, nice attractive amenities in the vicinity, I think make Boise, you know, a destination for manufacturers and for more service industries and so on. So I think it's going to continue to grow, actually. Yeah. Yes. I do think it's going to make it, and this is already, you know, we're a good part down this road already, but it makes places like Red Lodge, Montana, for example, and I have friends there that are doing high-tech jobs, doing consulting. So I think it makes it easier. It reduces the cost of distance, I guess, to put it in abstract terms. It reduces the cost of distance. So what that means is it's easier for people to have more choice in where they want to live. And so for the West, relating it to that particular region, I think given the kinds of environments that people like to live in, which are generally, you know, coastal, they're mountain, selective, you know, desert environments, these are oftentimes very fragile places. And those are precisely the places, right, that these people are often going to want to migrate to. And even though they're not huge in number, they do have a pretty formative impact on the landscape because they oftentimes build pretty large houses and they have pretty large pieces of property, which then fragment, you know, wildlife corridors and so forth. So even though their numbers maybe are not huge, their footprint is actually considerable, you know. And so I think it's a process that we've seen really accelerated by the internet, obviously, and that kind of remote connectivity. But we may only be in the second or third inning of much more of that, I think. Yeah, in terms of what it's going to do to the West. Yeah. It's often, yes, and you do see that. And it's oftentimes in many of these high amenity settings where you have, and some of them are quite near my home, Big Sky, Montana would be a nice example, where you have a large minimum wage workforce, right, that is working at these ski resorts, doing a lot of service jobs and so forth. They can't afford to live there. They have to live, you know, down canyon or in some other remote locality. And then you have oftentimes a very, very, you know, top one half of 1%, maybe, right, that owns the largest homes in those settings. I don't think it's unique to the West. I think, you know, you do have that as just part of the economic system, right, that we're a part of. I think it's larger than the West. But I think it's interesting to see how it plays out spatially in the West and to see how it plays out. For example, I've got one of my pictures in the ski resort section is actually a picture of where all the folks that work in Vail actually live. you know, which is a very, very sort of, it's about 30 miles away, and there's a lot of little duplexes and double wides and so forth. So oftentimes there's some interesting spatial patterns that flow out of the social stratification, you know, and as a geographer, that's what's interesting for me. Yeah.
How has GIS changed the field of geography?
Huge. GIS, geographic information systems or science. And that has given geographers, it's what works our GPS units, you know, in our cars and so forth. And it has given the generation of students that I've educated jobs, a lot of them, you know. And GIS is used by many public agencies, by many engineering consulting firms to help locate where we are on the surface of the Earth, right, in very precise ways. It helps also to analyze very complicated issues like where to put a subdivision, you know, and what kind, in a GIS system, you can put in things about the geology, you can put in things about the surface drainage, you can put in things about the climate, all the potential costs maybe of different sort of water and sewer systems. Put that on basically a computerized version of a map and then look at different solutions and so forth. So it has transformed our discipline, yeah, in wonderful ways. Absolutely. I like to think this is part of our discipline, too, you know, as a geographer, as a cultural historical geographer. I mean, I know a GIS firm did all the maps for my book, for example. You know, I worked with them. And so it facilitates a lot of the stuff that I do. But I think geography is also the story about landscape and about place history and those things. And GIS can be a tool, but geography also includes those things, I think, you know? So I hope we retain that part of it, too. Yeah, up here. Well, you know, one maybe unsatisfying answer might be that water's been too cheap, okay? I think that's the answer, in a sense, you know? And that, in other words, people have not had enough of an incentive because it's been cheap and relatively available. And in some cases, maybe there are technological improvements that people aren't incentivized to take advantage of, right? So it's not a technological problem. It really is a problem of cultural change and of philosophical change, maybe even, right? And prioritizing differently. But, you know, many of us know farm families, ranch families, and there is a great heritage there too, right? And a great knowledge, accumulated knowledge about land as well. But oftentimes, I would agree with you, there is resistance. And I think, you know, we're still playing catch up, and we probably always will be, frankly, to our needs, right? I mean, I don't think we're ever going to be water surplus in the West, that's for sure. Anyone else? Yeah. A little bit. Not a lot, because there are great specialty studies that look at that. I just was up in Yellowstone National Park last Thursday, in fact. In fact, the University of Washington Press has a nice little blog, so I wrote up my little trip to Yellowstone, but it has to do with your question. And there is a new plan just put out last week, two weeks ago now, by the Department of the Interior to take the Yellowstone bison and to redistribute them into 20 different spots all over the West, right, as a way of reintroducing this species to part of their native environment and so forth. Well, of course, the ranchers of the West fear brucellosis. They fear disease transmission. And so it's a great example of what you're asking about, and that is this tension oftentimes between domestic, you know, livestock interests and wildlife advocates. And space is at the center of it, right, because both groups need and want space. The hope with the bison, by the way, just to give you the 30-second synopsis, is that maybe we can build quarantine shelters of sufficient, keep the bison quarantined and their offspring quarantined, that will eradicate any threat of brucellosis, and then we can go ahead and redistribute. But I would say don't hold your breath on that one. You know, it's not going to happen overnight, because the ranching interests are powerful interests in this country. Yeah. Well, you know, and I'm a native of Southern California, and my parents were both born there in Southern California. I would say that a lot of prayer is in order, first of all, for a sustained El Nino event, which will, in the very, very short term, maybe help out California. But to seriously answer your question, I think California will continue to be in the national headlines. because of those pictures that we saw last winter, right, of the depleted reservoirs and so forth, right? And the huge questions about, well, do you save maybe a species of fish, or do you farm, or do you keep a suburb going, you know? And so California right now is in the crosshairs, I think, of these water issues. Plus, it's been hit by this absolutely devastating drought. I mean, I was in California over the winter and in the Bay Area, and it was the worst drought in memory. And, you know, maybe we'll get an El Nino this year, which usually means wet conditions in California, maybe not. But that longer period of drought, I think, is going to continue to come more frequently. Yeah, just to follow up. The people in Oregon? Right. Don't Californicate Oregon, isn't that the old saying, right? It does introduce a lot of stress, right? And, you know, those kinds of, I think those kinds of episodes are going to continue, yeah, to get more focused in the future. Yeah, time for maybe one more. Yeah, go ahead.
Did you meet any high-technology tractors used on farms?
I met, you know, high-tech farmers, yeah. And in terms of going back to your earlier point about GIS, you know, there's this whole notion of precision farming, where you can take, you know, your detailed knowledge of your fields and so forth, and much more efficiently, you know, use fertilizers and nutrients, and it sounds like you're familiar with it too. And that is becoming, it's a capital-intensive thing. It's an example of that bigness, right, though, because it does take an amount of, you know, education and capital investment to make that all happen. But yes, you do see that, and it's a lot increasingly in the Great Plains too, that region, yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you all for coming. Thanks for the great questions. Really enjoyed it. Really appreciated it. And I'll be happy to stay around for a few minutes if anybody has other questions or wants me to sign a book.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.